Okay. This is going to be a little bit of a different podcast. This is just me and my story. So, probably the biggest story that's happened to me in cycling is I actually tested positive in 2013 after my very first drug test as a junior when I was 18 years old, or maybe I was 17 at the time, or I was just about to turn 18. I tested positive. And if you Google my name, if you Google Jack Burke, one of the things that'll pop up are some articles on that, because I have a super unique story there that I assume a lot of people, or most people, would know about, but maybe this is just going to come as a shocker to some of you. And the thing with my story is there's a lot that was never told, that was strategically never made public by the governing bodies and whatnot, because maybe it kind of makes them look a little bit bad for how they dealt with the case, and a lot of unique things that happened with the case. And so there's just a lot of information that was never made public. And if you were never in the room where there were two trials for my case, or two hearings, I guess, that happened, and unless you were in the room there, or you had ever spoken to me or asked me about it, you wouldn't know about it. And so this happened in 2013, so that's a long time ago. That's 7 years ago, and I've never talked about this since then, because it's something that's really hard for me to talk about, and I've mostly just put it out of my mind. So this is going to be an interesting podcast. This is going to be difficult for me to record. It's just me by myself here, and I'm basically having to dredge all this up, because I've kind of put it out of the back of my mind for a long time, because it's always been something that's really painful for me to talk about. So, I'm not going to say like I'm over it or anything like that, but I was talking to one of my mentors, Mike Creed, on the phone. We were just chatting and catching up, and you know, he just said, he encouraged me to try to tell this story, because the reality is a lot of the information is not out there, and you wouldn't know. And he's someone who's read everything that is out there that's accessible to the public, and he still didn't know a lot of the stuff that was out there. So he encouraged me to tell this story and just put all the facts out there. And then maybe we would do a follow-up episode together where he can just try to, you know, question me and, clarify a lot of the stuff that maybe isn't clear in this, or things that maybe I go over, questions that anyone might have. And, you know, so I guess this will probably be like a two-part podcast where we go over it. But anyways, I'm going to try to keep it together going through this, and I'm probably going to ramble a lot, and I'm probably going to jump around a lot, but there's no real script to this. This is just going to be me going over everything. So I guess where to start is just kind of the lead up to this. So this happened in 2013, and that was the second year I had ever been road cycling. That was my second year racing as a junior. I had done one the year before that, my first year racing as a junior. I had kind of done half and half, racing on the road and cross-country mountain biking. That's where I started, and I started mountain biking just as like building dirt jumps with my buddies and having fun with my hockey friends. And then I took up, sorry, I need to breathe a bit going through this story. This is actually really hard. I was a mountain biker before, and I kind of did a year half and half on the road, and then the following year I decided I was going to dive in all in on the road. And at the time, so I would have been 16 or 17 at the time, and I had a girlfriend I was seeing, and she had a lot of mental health issues, like severe mental health issues, and it turned out she was very suicidal, and she was coming from a very dysfunctional family. She was, you know, the stereotypical very popular girl at school and looks like she has a dream life, but ends up coming from a very broken home that I didn't know about at the time. And, you know, she was, you know, cutting herself, and she was suicidal, and she didn't have anyone else to talk to other than myself, and put a lot of that on me. And as, you know, we went our separate ways, I was kind of the one for her to hang on to and reach out to and be a support network. And she basically put a lot of that on me, which led to a lot of depression in my own life. And that's actually the darkest point I've ever had in my life, is that period of, I don't know, maybe a year and a half, 2 years of dealing with that. Out of anything I've ever dealt with in my life, that was by far the darkest. Even after going through all this with testing positive and being wrongly accused of that, that was the darkest time of my life. And as a way to kind of escape that, I just threw myself into cycling, and training and pushing myself really hard was an easy way to kind of escape that pain that I was dealing with at the time. And so I trained so freaking hard at that time. And cycling was really kind of the only thing I had at the time as a kid. You know, I didn't really fit in with the high school crowd because I didn't want to smoke and drink. At the time, that's where a lot of my friends that I grew up playing hockey with, we had always been like the athletes at school. And then they started getting into drinking and smoking and partying, and I didn't really want to get into that scene. And so I gravitated towards cycling and throwing myself into training. And I think that's very much the case with most young kids in high school that get into cycling. They don't quite fit in with the high school cool kids anymore, and so they choose to go down this path of training. And so cycling was my entire life at the time. My life was, I'd wake up at 4:45 or 4:15, depending on what the training was, in the morning. I'd get my training in before school, and I grew up in downtown Toronto, like proper downtown Toronto, so this would often be on the trainer, or I'd ride out into the suburbs a bit, and I'd get my training done in the morning, and then I'd go to school, and then after school, I would go work at the local bike shop from 4:15 to 9:30 at night, every night, and then, like, I had a very structured routine. This is my routine every day. And then after that, I'd take an ice bath right before going to bed, because you'd be standing at the bike shop for those hours after being at school and training in the morning, and so my legs would be really sore. And so I'd take an ice bath, and my grandmother, or Oma, was living with us at the time, and, you know, she obviously had nothing to do all day, so I put her straight to work. I bought 28 ice cube trays from the dollar store, because that was the most we could cram into her freezer, and I would have her reload those ice cube trays every day and fill those up for me, and then I would take an ice bath every night. I'd empty all the ice cube trays into these big Costco bags and haul them to the bathtub and take an ice bath and then just pass out going to bed. And I was drinking like a liter of coffee every day then. And I remember I managed to, I don't know what, I think it's different in the U.S. I think in the U.S. they have prom for every year of high school, but in Canada we only have prom for the 12th grade. And over the course of my high school life, I ended up going to 4 proms, but I missed my own because there was a bike race, and I ended up winning those races that we went to go do that weekend, so it was totally worth it. But, you know, I just was totally out of school. School was just like in the way. All I wanted to do was focus on cycling. And because I was training so hard and because of what I was trying to escape in my personal life at the time, I got really good at the bike, at cycling, and I got really strong. And, you know, everyone's kind of going through puberty, and I guess I was kind of hitting it well there. And so in that, my second year racing as a junior and my first real full year on the road, I was the best junior in Canada at the time, which was really cool. And, you know, the future was looking really bright for me at the time. And so I was racing with the national team. I was always selected for that, and I was the leader there, like the GC rider there, which was great. And everything's going really well. And I got selected to do the Tour de Abitibi. And so the Tour de Abitibi happens. And sorry, I'm just going to back up a second here. Just to give you a couple little facts here before I keep continuing on with the story. Basically, I'll get into more of these in a bit, but just like the quick hit facts that everyone should know, just so you have an idea what in the world I'm talking about in case you've never heard any of this, is I'm the only athlete in the history of sport, so the history of anti-doping in sport. So ever since they started testing athletes, drug testing athletes in any sport, any time, any level, college, professional, amateur, whatever, as far as I know, I'm still the only athlete in the history of anti-doping to have tested positive, but to have been found to bear no fault in it, and to actually be found completely innocent in it, as in we managed to prove that I did absolutely nothing wrong, and I didn't even receive a reprimand or a first strike. And what that means, for anyone that doesn't know, is if you test positive and you know, you get your suspension at first. Now in cycling, that first, if you test positive, it's 4 years, but if you get a second strike It's a lifetime ban. And so, you know, I didn't even get a first strike in this. I didn't get any sanction, nothing. And they gave me my results back. But as I'll get into later, there was a little bit of, I mean, I guess like blackmail, really, in that ended up taking that result away from me in order to try to keep this whole story quiet, which I didn't sign the NDA that was pushed to me at the time. And anyways, I'll get into that. But there was another key point is this case, there was, as it went on towards the final hearing in New York City, we had to fly out for that. There were some things about the case that we didn't quite understand, like why the UCI and WADA were doing certain things that they were doing didn't quite make sense. And we get to this final hearing in New York, and I walk into this giant conference room. There's a huge table there, and there's all these big shot lawyers and arbitrators from the UCI and WADA. And if you've ever seen the Icarus documentary, which I assume a lot of people have, all the same names you see in there that have investigated the Russian doping case, so Richard McLaren and all these other names, those were the people that, before they did that, they did my case. So it's the biggest names you can get in anti-doping. We're all about to rule on my case, and the person, the lawyer representing the UCI, so kind of like the prosecutor, the person that's supposed to be pointing, that's sitting across the table from me, and is supposed to be pointing at me and saying, you're a doper, you're a cheat, you know, we want you to be suspended. That he's supposed to be saying that, and that's what I'm expecting. And he was the lawyer for Alberto Contador, who claimed a very similar case that what we had managed to prove in my case, which again, I'll have to get into and explain more of this. You know, he is the perfect guy. You know, he had represented Alberto Contador, and he had been on the other side of this. Like, there is no better person in the world to basically throw the book at me and ruin my life and rip my life apart. And I'm going in there terrified because I'm thinking I've done nothing wrong, and this guy's going to rip my life apart. My whole life is cycling. It's all I have. And he's going to take it all away from me. And I haven't even got started. Like, I'm dreaming about the Tour de France and the Olympics and all this stuff. And everything's going so well. I'm doing so well at this sport. And this is happening. And he opens the hearing. This is the final hearing. We're sitting across the table. His opening statement, basically, and in front of the arbitrator and in front of us, says, I'm paraphrasing here, we know you didn't do anything wrong. We know this is a bit of a glitch in the system, and that this is, you know, not an accident, but, you know, this shouldn't have happened. And we know you didn't do anything wrong, and we know you didn't try to cheat, and we know, you know, you're telling the truth here, but your case is incredibly precedent setting. And that's why we had to appeal your case and go through this whole process and, you know, drag my life through the mud for the last year, is because they were worried that athletes in the future that were doping, that did do something, like that did try to cheat, would then turn around and use my case as precedent in order for them to get off. And so they were basically trying to cover themselves from that happening in the future. And so I'm sitting across the table having just heard this, and I'm partially enraged because it's like, you've ripped my life apart. You've ruined my name and my career and dragged my life through the mud for the last year. And no one at this table thinks I did anything wrong, and you just admitted it. But like, you need to go admit that to the whole world and tell the world that. And they never did. And that's why I guess I'm making this podcast. And, you know, that's some of the information that never came out. So, you know, part of me was enraged about that. And part of me was thinking, oh, what a relief that they believe me. Like, I don't have to scream I didn't do this anymore. But, so, you know, that's probably the biggest key point that people wouldn't know about. And then a second point, and I promise before I'll go back and go over more of this story going into it. But the second key point would be that after that second ruling, I got my results back for that. So after the first ruling, I didn't get a sanction, I didn't get a first strike, but they said, your results from that race won't count. And I'll get more into that in a second. And I said, okay, well, you know, that's the most favorable ruling an athlete had ever received so far already. So I was like, you know what, that sucks. That's the best result I've ever had in my career to date. But you know, it clearly it could have been a lot worse. They ended up actually giving me that result back. So now I literally have had no consequences officially from this. I get to keep my result. I get, there's no first warning. There's no sanction. You bear no fault there. It couldn't get any better than that. Aside from all the public backlash that that was going to now come after all this was made public. But so as this is happening, there's, if you Google my name again, there's one article that will come up is the Toronto Star article. It's the big newspaper in Toronto, Canada. And they did a whole story on this as soon as this case happened. And they contacted me for an interview for this. And then the next day I got an email from the UCI. And I believe it was Pat McQuaid was who had signed it at the bottom of this note. And this is right before he was ousted. Like, I think he was not reelected maybe like a month later. So I like to think this is like one of the last things he did in as the president of the UCI. I got a letter from him saying that the UCI wants me to sign an NDA, so a non-disclosure agreement, about this whole case, saying that I wouldn't talk about this, I couldn't talk about this to anybody, including the Toronto Star article. They were trying to shut up the Toronto Star article from coming out because they knew how they would look in this. It's like you basically just bullied this junior rider. And so the ultimatum they gave me was, you can sign, if you don't sign this NDA about this, we're going to take away your Abitibi results, the result that I had just got back from the arbitrator, just giving me that back. And I'm still, to this day, I'm confused as to how they can do that. I don't know if they can legally do, I mean, the UCI, I guess they can do what they want, but I earned that result, and then they took it away at first because they thought there was a doping infraction that happened there. Then they found out there wasn't anything, and we proved that, and so they gave me the result back, and then the UCI said, if you don't sign this NDA, we're going to take that result away. And I said, well, I'm not signing that NDA, so I guess you can take the result away again. Because in my mind, I was thinking, you know, my dreams are still, I want to go to the Olympics and the tour, and what if I one day win an Olympic medal and a reporter sticks a microphone in my face and asks me about this time when I was a junior and tested positive in front of the whole world on TV, and I have to say, I'm sorry, I can't talk about that, you know, if I can't explain the story and you're only getting these little bits and pieces that was ever made public, that would look horrible for me, and there'd be so many questions. So I said, there's no way I could sign that NDA. So that article ended up coming out, and it does a pretty good job of explaining a lot of the stuff that happens, but it is quite long, and there is still stuff that's missing, so hopefully this helps clear it up. So those are just two interesting key points that you wouldn't know from any of the again, sorry, I gotta keep breathing here to keep myself together, that you wouldn't know from anything you can read online. But anyways, back to the how this all happened. We go to Abitibi, and it's the longest stage race for junior cyclists, and it's like the biggest stage race for junior cyclists in the world, which is really cool that it happens up in Canada. Stage three is so the third day of the race, there's two stages in one day. So there's a time trial in the morning, and then there's a circuit race in the afternoon. And that time trial, at the time, my best attribute was time trialing. That was my best discipline, and I was winning all the time trials that I had entered that year, and I won it, and it was a huge result. I was so honored. I was wearing the maple leaf, and this was the biggest race we had ever done, and I just won the time trial, and I set the course record on that course that they had done so many times, and so many big names before me have done this race, like the biggest names in cycling, and for me to win and set the course record on it was just incredible. And so everybody is obviously ecstatic about that. And funny enough, another one of my podcast guests, Will Barta, was actually the guy who got second in that time trial to me. That was when we were racing together as juniors. He was racing for the U.S. and I was racing for Canada. And so I think if you actually look at Wikipedia, because they took that result away from me, I think he has that result now. If you Google our names, I think he got my result. But I'm still a little bit bitter about that. Will, I won that time trial. I don't care what Wikipedia says. But anyways, so we do the time trial in the morning. And because of that, I got selected to do for anti-doping, for drug testing. And so they take the winner of the stage, that's a given. And usually for the juniors, it's like two other random names for it. But because it was a double stage day, and that was the first stage, there's a rule that says they can't test you after that stage in the morning. And so they would have to drug test me after the second stage that day, after the second circuit race that was going to happen that evening. So everything's fine. We go back. And for anyone who hasn't done Abitibi before, all the riders, we live in a school because this is during the summer holidays. So there's no kids in school. And they literally just put mattresses up in classrooms. And that's where they hold the whole race, which is pretty crazy. It's quite the wild experience. But anyways, for this second stage, they had to bus us 80 kilometers away to a small town in Quebec called Malartic. And Malartic has the biggest open pit gold mine in all of Canada. And one of the problems with gold mines and just mining in general is the strain it puts on the groundwater. And so again, we'll get into that. So we finished the time trial that morning. Everyone's resting in the classrooms and on our mattresses and whatnot. And then it's time to get ready to go for the second stage. And so everyone has to get on these school buses to go. And everybody's filling up their water bottles in the school where we're staying. And in the school, it's just these little water fountains like you would see at any primary school. And I was running a little bit late packing up my bag and everything to go to the race. And there was a huge line around like the two water fountains for all these riders to fill up their bottles with. And we all have like five or six bottles we got to fill up because you don't have soigneurs and stuff like that as a junior. So everyone's filling up, you know, five, six water bottles and whatnot for the stage. And there's a huge line for that. So I said, oh, screw it. I'll fill up my bottles at the start, wherever this is, wherever we're going. So I get on the bus. All the riders get on the bus. We drive to the second stage. We get there. As soon as we get out of the buses, the team's all getting set up. Where the start was at a hockey arena. And again, because it was the middle of the summer, there was no hockey going on. And so the whole arena was shut down, but they had opened it up just so they could use the bathrooms for the anti-doping after. You have to go to the bathroom. That's where they were going to do the drug tests, where they were going to collect all the samples after the stage. And so it was opened up just for that. And so this is the only building around. We're starting in the middle of absolutely nowhere. It's literally this hockey arena, a golf course that wasn't being used or open, I guess. And then nothing, like is a tiny little town in the middle of nowhere. And so I'm running around trying to find a place to fill up my water bottles. I get into the hockey arena, into the building, but everything's locked. There's no water fountains around. I finally find this lady that works there, and she ends up unlocking the sports bar that's there and filling up my water bottles at the tap that's there. And this is really funny. Like now that I remember this and almost like foreshadowing for everything that would happen. Is she said to me, she was French Canadian, so her English was limited, and so she put her finger to her lips and said, like, shh, don't tell anybody about this. I don't want to have to come unlock the door to fill up more. I don't want, you know, 50 riders coming and asking me to fill up their water bottles. I said, okay, yeah, sure, no problem, whatever. Everyone else had filled up their bottles at the school. Anyway, so I fill up my bottles, we go, we do the stage, we finish the race, and I didn't know that I was going to be drug tested. Like, I'm sure probably the coaches and stuff knew, oh, Jack won the time trial this morning, they're going to drug test him, but I didn't know that. But anyways, the stage ends, and I get selected to do a drug test. I'm like, oh, this is kind of cool, like, I'd never done that before. Like, you know, I didn't really understand the process of peeing in a cup right in front of an older man, which is, you know, it's really weird now, but at the time, it was kind of cool because it's like, wow, I guess I'm kind of making it into the big leagues now. I guess this is what the pros do. This is kind of cool. I know that sounds so weird and dorky, but, you know, cycling is very weird anyways, and we're all pretty weird to get into the sport. But anyways, I do the drug test, and we continue on the race. Race ends. Everything's fine. And a couple months later, I'm at my home. I remember exactly where I was. I'm sitting at home. And I just got off school, so I'm going through my whole schedule here. I just got off school. I ran home as I did every day to grab basically like my dinner that I would eat at work later that night. And then I had to get back on my bike and ride to work to start working. Like I had like a 45 minute window between the end of school and the start of my shift at the bike shop. And I opened my phone, checked my email, and I get an email from the UCI, and it said, you know, adverse analytical finding addressed to me. And I remember just reading it and being so confused. But as it started, as I was reading it and started to see what it meant, like I didn't really know what adverse analytical finding was. Like they don't just tell you, you tested positive in a drug test, this is really bad. You know, they use much more professional, and I'm so ignorant. I'll get into this. I'm so ignorant to cycling at the time. Like I don't know anything about bike racing. You know, I just liked riding my bike. I didn't follow bike racing. You know, like I never watched bike racing on TV or really knew anything about it. You know, it took me going to the world championships later that year before my dad finally stopped calling the Peloton the Pentagon. You know, like I didn't know anything about cycling. I didn't come from a cycling family. And I'm reading this email and I'm starting to understand what it means, having to read this document over and over again. And I remember I started to shake so much I had to put my phone down on my desk because I couldn't, I was shaking so much. I was so afraid as to what the hell is happening here. Like, this has to be a mistake. This isn't, there's a mistake here. There's something wrong here. This isn't real. Or like they must have sent this to the wrong person, or they got the wrong sample or something like that. There must have been like a mix up at the lab or something. And I called my dad on the phone and I'm just like freaking out on the phone to tell him, like, I don't know what to do. Like, what's happening? And this, I remember I was on the phone with him as I was riding my bike because I had to get to my shift at work. And I'm like riding my bike and talking to my dad on the phone shift there. And, you know, he's pretty calm about it because he's just like, yeah, it's like clearly this is a mistake or something. Like, don't worry, relax. It's, you know, well, they must have sent the email to the wrong person. So I'm like, oh, this is like how ignorant we are. You know, they don't send the wrong email about this. They don't screw this up. At least that part, they don't mess up in this. And anyways, I'm having to get through my shift at the bike shop here. And for the next couple months working, and just this is, of course, on my mind 24/7. I'm not sleeping anymore. This is the only thing on my mind, and having to get through this crazy schedule and whatnot. And this is happening. And then I reached out to my coach at the time, or like the guy that ran the club I was riding for, which is the NCCH, which is the Ontario, which is the National Cycling Center Hamilton. That's the team I rode for as a junior, the club team I rode for. And Rick Lee was my coach at the time and the one that ran the team. And I reached out to him, and I was supposed to go do track nationals in like 2 weeks or something like that. And we were, myself and my closest friends at the time, we were totally going to go crush the team pursuit there. And, you know, I was trying to get ready for that and then make selections for the world championships that were the junior world championships that were going to happen in Italy later in September. And so I guess this would have been like August time, and the world championships would have been at the end of September. And this is probably around the end of August. And like Rick understood what this was at the time, and like he understood how serious this was. And so what they did is they actually suspended me from the team quietly and didn't take me to the track national championships, which, you know, I never really loved track nationals, but that would have been, you know, my teammates ended up winning I was supposed to be in that team and they won the national title and it was great. And that would have been a lot of fun to go win that with them, but they kept me back because they didn't know what was going to happen. So they just took me out of racing there very quietly at the time. And anyways, we're going through this whole thing and we're trying to understand, you know, like what the hell happened. My dad's asking me, you know, we're trying to figure out how this could have happened. Like, we don't know anything about this. And my dad's asking me all these questions, you know, getting me to walk him through the whole day. And he comes up with the idea somehow about contaminated well water or something like that. And I'm looking at him like, what are you talking about? And he had been researching all this stuff about the time. Like, he was looking on Google Earth and Google Maps to try to figure out about the area and whatnot for this. And he comes up with this theory, and then we ended up getting a pro bono lawyer named James Bunting. And my God, he was like freaking Superman. He was my guardian angel that came in this, because he did everything pro bono. He never charged any money for this. He did it just because he believed in me and believed in my case. And thank God he came in and helped me out here and my family, because we had no idea what any of this was. So he guided us through this. So my dad's explaining this ridiculous theory to him and to me, and I'm writing it off like, Dad, you're nuts. Like, you're grasping. You got to, like, break your arm. You're grasping so hard here. And, but anyways, we start going through this. And, by the way, the drug that I tested positive for, I guess I haven't said that yet, is hydrochlorothiazide. And I had never heard of that either when this all happened. It's a diuretic. And so what it does is it just makes you pee. It's like no different. You take this and it's like drinking a cup of coffee where it just makes you pee. And so it's prescribed a lot to senior citizens to help with blood pressure and water retention. And it's a banned substance because in weight cutting sports like wrestling or boxing, it can obviously help you make weight. Cycling, that's obviously not the case, and taking a diuretic would actually hurt your performance. But the reason it's banned also in cycling is, one, because WADA, it's just on the list because it would help the weightlifters, and so it gets put on the list for them, and the list is basically just applied to all sports. And the other reason why it's technically on the list for cyclists can't take this, not that you never would want to take this because it's just going to dehydrate you, like, and that's all it does. But the reason it's banned for cyclists is it's considered a masking agent is what they call it. And so it could theoretically help you hide drugs, other performance enhancing drugs. So you're taking your performance enhancing drugs and then you would take this with it so that you pee out the drugs faster and don't get caught. So that's the theory behind it, but it's such an ineffective way to hide performance enhancing drugs. Like, it's such an ineffective way to try to get around cheating that you'd never do that. So it wouldn't work. It's such an archaic, out of date way of doing it. And with how sophisticated the technology is for testing samples and finding trace amounts, it would not work in today's time. Like, this is a technique you maybe would have used in like the 80s when they're taking, you know, speed and amphetamines and strychnine. You know, this isn't for anything in the last 30 years of drug testing. You know, if you read any of even Tyler Hamilton and Lance Armstrong, when they talk about what kind of doping techniques they did, they don't talk about masking agents is how they got away from hiding it, because that just doesn't work. The tests now are far too sophisticated to get fooled by that. But anyways, that's why it's technically on the list. So that's the drug they found in me. Another unique scenario about this, like, in a lot, like, I essentially got hit by lightning in this, like, the storm of events that all happened that we managed to put together to put this whole story together and prove the whole exactly what happened. We got incredibly lucky that we were able to prove all of this, but the crazy storm of events that happened that led up to this is quite ridiculous. And so the next thing is the amount they found in me. So the amount in my sample was 0.8 nanograms per milliliter of urine. And for anyone who doesn't know what that means, that's less than one billionth with a B, not millionth, billionth of a gram. That's the amount that was in me. And it's such a small amount that they ended up finding through this whole, through the appeals court and everything, out of all the WADA, so that's World Anti-Doping Agency, out of all the WADA labs in the world, there's only two that at the time that had equipment sophisticated enough to find such a small amount. And those two laboratories were the one in Montreal and the one in Switzerland. And of course, the only drug test I've ever done, it happens to be in Quebec, and that sample goes to Montreal. So this is another thing where it's like, had this had happened in Mexico, Colombia, wherever in Europe other than Switzerland, had this test had happened or gone anywhere else, none of this would have even happened because the amount they found was so small. But there's no threshold in the anti-doping rules for this drug. It just says if it's in your system, you get a ban. Doesn't matter how much. If we find it there, you're banned. So that's one of the problems with the rules there. And another, so just to be clear, even if you were to try to say it's like, okay, he took this drug on purpose, he was trying to use this, all it is a diuretic. it would just have made me dehydrated. It's not a performance enhancing drug. It just makes you pee. That's all it does. And there was not, even if you multiplied it by 1,000 times, it's not enough to even do anything. And it's not enough to mask any other drugs. So they would have, if I was trying to come up with some scenario where I was using this to hide performance enhancing drugs, you would have seen the performance enhancing drugs, because there wasn't nearly enough of this to mask anything. So like, these are the ridiculous little bits that are a little hard to understand just by reading, you know, articles in cycling magazines that have reported on the case. But anyways, my dad comes up with this crazy theory about contaminated drinking water, and to basically summarize all this, we end up looking at where I filled up my water bottles. I told them I filled them up at this hockey arena. Behind that hockey arena, part of this whole sports complex, is a golf course. And, you know, I remembered that. I was like, yeah, there was a golf course there. We're all sitting in these fields getting dressed before the stage in camp chairs, and there's a golf course right there. And in the middle of that golf course is a well. And the town runs on well water, and that hockey arena's pipes, the water that came out of the pipes from that hockey arena where I filled up my water bottles, came from that well in the middle of that golf course. And the drug that they found in me, hydrochlorothiazide, is found in extremely high concentrations in the fertilizer that's used on that golf course. That is how I basically got hit by lightning there. It's a crazy scenario. And it's like, it sounds maddening. It's like, you're blaming this on drinking water, blah, blah, blah. Like, every cyclist and person that's tested positive has used every excuse in the book to this. And going back, you know, Contador, he claimed when he tested positive, that, oh, it's contaminated meat and whatnot. And, you know, another difference there is the drug they found in him, clenbuterol, that's actually a performance enhancing drug. That's a steroid. That's another difference there. And we were able to prove this in the second case. So that is what was so amazing, is we got lucky. My dad had this crazy theory, and that we were able to, in the end, prove it with this by getting wastewater experts and going down all these roads and like exhausting every expert and whatnot and testing everything in order to prove this. And that's why I'm the only athlete in the history of sport that is been found to bear no fault in this, because I'm the only one that could prove a negative. That's what's impossible. So many of these athletes that even if they're innocent of it, it's impossible to prove a negative. You know, you can't, it's hard. You can't prove a negative. That's the easiest way to put it. And I got incredibly unlucky that this happened. But I got incredibly lucky that we managed to, in this one rare scenario, prove a negative there. But anyways, this first case is now happening, and we have to go through the whole first trial of this, and we have the trial. Everything is basically like expedited because the world championships are coming up now. I've already missed the track national championships, like suspended, just non-officially, but just my team just said, we're not going to take you, just because, you know, if this came back, they didn't want the team's results to get wiped out and all the other riders to get their results wiped out if, let's say, I was found guilty or something in the end of all this. So I've made all the selections for the national team to go to the World Championships in Italy, and I'm, you know, a favorite basically going into the time trial there. I'm, you know, expected to do really well at this race. And, you know, I'm stressed beyond belief because of all this is going on, but none of this is public yet. So I'm having to like hold, everyone's wishing me well and hyping me up to go to the World Championships and so excited for me. And I have all this weighing on my mind as far as if I'm even going to be allowed to go or what's going to happen and if my life is totally falling apart. But anyways, the trial happens, or the first hearing happens the day before I was supposed to fly to Italy for this race. So my parents ended up going into debt to buy me the flight ticket to go to Italy to do this race, and believing that, you know, karma would come around and, you know, the right thing would happen and, you know, I'd be allowed to do it. So they took a huge risk there because they certainly didn't have the money to buy me a flight ticket there. So they took on the debt to do that, buy me this flight ticket. We still don't know. The trial's the day before the hearing, is with Richard McLaren, who is the one who is basically the head honcho from the World Anti-Doping Agency that you see in the Icarus documentary. If you watch that, there you'll see him there as well. He was the one that had to oversee my whole case. And the UCI was, they were arguing, no, we think this isn't well water. We think this is contaminated supplements. We think, you know, this must be a contaminated supplement. So even at the with the least amount of information, the biggest argument they were making was still not that he tried to cheat here. Like, that, it just doesn't make sense. There's no scenario you could make that up. Like, you could say that he's trying to cheat somehow. They were saying it's like, okay, it must be like a contaminated supplement. And obviously with like a week's notice or whatever we had to do this, we couldn't get the supplements tested or get the well water tested or anything like that. So we were basically making the case, explaining with what we have without the concrete evidence yet. And so that was the UCI's case. This hearing goes on for 6 hours. And again, it's all these suits in a big conference room, and I'm walking in my American Eagle t-shirt and khaki shorts, because that was, you know, I didn't have a suit. I was a teenager at the time. I certainly didn't have a suit. I didn't own a tie or anything like that, so I just had like a button-up shirt and some khaki shorts that I would wear to work at the bike shop. That was the most formal attire I had at the time. And so I'm doing that, and I remember in that trial, or the hearing, it took 6 hours, and at one point when my dad is trying to explain this whole thing, he broke down and started just bawling, crying. And I had never seen any emotion from my dad. I was so confused and upset and just in shock seeing that. My household was not about showing that, the emotions between, you know, the guys, my dad, my brother, and I. It's like, we didn't hug, we shook hands, and there was never, never any emotion there at all. So to see him start crying, I'm just, like, my eyes are lighting up, like, what is going on right now? He was so upset about this whole thing as to what was happening to my life. And I, of course, you know, want to scream this whole time. It's like, listen, guys, like, I swear on my mother's grave, I didn't do anything wrong here. Like, please just let me race. I didn't do anything here. I'm telling the truth, I promise. And, of course, everybody claims that. Everybody says that. But this hearing ends up taking 6 hours, which I didn't anticipate was the time. Rick's coaching me at the time. I got to get on a plane the next day to go fly to this race that we don't even know if they're going to let me race yet. And, you know, I got to box up the bike still, but I was supposed to do a training session that day that I said that I planned on doing after this hearing, because I didn't think it was going to take so long, because I had to go do a training session in order to test out some wheels and tires that I was going to use on the TT bike there. And so you can't do it on the train, you got to do it on the road. But by the time this hearing ends and everything, you know, Rick had put this on the training plan for the day. And I get back and it's got to be like 10:30 at night, and I have some food and I'm like, well, I got to go do the training session, and you can't do it in downtown Toronto. So I was like, well, I'm just going to go do it outside. I'm going to go do it out on the roads that I always train on outside. And so I'm loading up my TT bike into the back of mom's Volvo station wagon. And I vividly remember, if anyone's seen that, I was such a fan of the Rocky movies, and especially during this time, they were really what got me through this. Is, I know, as cheesy as that sounds, but man, my life was falling apart, and I was really clinging to those Rocky movies to keep me going. And there's the scene in Rocky IV where he fights Ivan Drago, the Russian, where he's just had the argument with Adrian about wanting to go do this, and he's leaving the mansion, and you see the Lamborghini Diablo with the license plate Southpaw, and he gets into the car, and the song There's No Easy Way Out starts playing, and he just rips off in the Lamborghini to the airport to go to Russia to fight Ivan Drago. And that was exactly what I was envisioning in mom's Volvo station wagon, which I think is really funny. But in my head, I was going to go, you know, I was going to tough this out. I was going to get it done, and one day my name would be cleared and everything would be fine. And you know, I got to be tougher. I got to get through this. I got to get this training done. They're not going to step in. They're not going to ruin my training and get in my way. It's like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night at this point. Like, it's pitch blackout. And I drive up to New Market, just outside of Toronto, where there's like the farm roads and stuff. Unload the bike. I don't have any lights or anything. And what's really funny is this basically foreshadows, you know, the years of riding in the dark and through the middle of the night that would then come in the years to come. But at the time, I didn't have any lights or anything. And I get on the TT bike to test out these wheels and do my efforts that I have to do. And I remember I had only ridden like maybe, you know, 5 to 10 kilometers, and I couldn't see a thing because there was no street lights. It's the middle of the night. I'm exhausted and like probably completely emotionally drained as well from just all this going on for how long. And I've just sat through this incredible hearing for 6 hours. And, you know, I just remember stopping on the side of the road and calling my coach, Rick, and basically feeling like ashamed and apologizing. I'm like, Rick, I'm sorry. I can't do the session. I can't see where I'm going. I can't see the road. Like, I'm sorry this hearing, it took longer than, I'm trying to like justify this and explain to him, like, I'm sorry. Like, you know, I didn't know the hearing was going to take that long, and I can't do the session. And I know I'm supposed to, how important this is to test out these wheels before we go to the race and everything, but I can't see where I'm going. And he just like basically laughed on the phone, or he didn't laugh because he knew how like fragile I was at the time. But, you know, he said, no worries, buddy. And now looking back, I'm like, what the hell was I thinking? Like, come on, you're going to go ride in the TT bike with a disc and aero wheels on a road in the middle of farm fields in the pitch black, full of potholes, and you can't see where you can't even see the road. But anyway, that's just like the headspace I was in at the time. Anyways, next morning comes, it's time to go fly to the race. And I'm standing in line at the airport with my two teammates, Adam Jamieson and Will Elliott, who have been selected to do the World Championships with me. And I'm standing in line at the airport with them. We finally get the phone call from James Bunting, my lawyer at the time, saying that Richard McLaren ruled that you're fine, you're okay to race, there's no sanction against you. We believe you, you're innocent, you're good to go. No restrictions on you. Go race. Good luck. And for a moment we're like, oh yes, thank goodness that's okay. But then the next hammer came and dropped. And there's a rule that no one was gonna know about. You wouldn't know about this rule unless you've had to undergo this. There's a rule that says there's only two races where during an ongoing case, because now the UCI has up to 30 days to appeal that decision to go up to the CAS, which is like the international courts for all this. And so like Russia has just appealed to the CAS to hear their case, and just to give you some context here. But in that 30-day period, so if it's still an ongoing case, the only two races where the UCI can then block you from racing are the World Championships and the Olympics. So in any other race, you're allowed to race while there's an ongoing case like this going on. But for those races, they can say no. And so now we had to hope that the UCI wasn't going to now say, you're not allowed to race the World Championships, even though, you know, this is the one race that they can block me from. And it's the one race I'm trying to go to. And so I get on the plane, I go to Italy with my teammates, and we ended up staying at Andrea Taffi's place. And, you know, he's a former Paris-Roubaix winner. That name meant nothing to me at the time. I had no idea who that was. I didn't know what Andrea Taffi or Mappe, or I didn't know what any of that was at the time. But we're staying in his room, and his Paris-Roubaix cobblestone is there. And I remember asking him, like the ignorant kid, being like, is that real? And he looked at me as like, well, they don't give out fake ones, you know. But and also the Rabobank women's team was staying there, and they won the women's team time trial there. So it was really cool to get to stay with them. But again, Mariana Voss and Pauline Ferrand-Prévot were on the team that year. I didn't know who either of them were at the time. I had no idea what, you know, I was wondering why there's this gold bike for Marianne, because she was the Olympic champion. I didn't know who that was or anything like that at the time, but they were staying there. And we end up staying there, and there's a couple days going by and we still don't know if I'm going to be allowed to race because the UCI could block me, and they should. In every other case, they have blocked the riders because they don't want to embarrass the name of their race for what's going on. So they should be, I should be getting an email saying you're not allowed to race until this, until we're finished our appeal process. But for some reason, less than 24 hours before my start time, we get an email saying the UCI is not going to block me from racing, but they're not giving up their right to appeal. So we don't know, okay, are they going to appeal or not, but they're going to let me race. And this is now less than 24 hours before my start time. And I, this has been weighing on me the whole time as I'm trying to prepare for the World Championships, where people are expecting me to do really well here. And so just the, like, the nerves and whatnot, I will never have nerves like that compared. I will never be nervous and anxious like that and that stressed out ever again in my life. There's no, I was ready to explode on that start line. But anyways, I do the race. I think I got like 18th or 19th. Like, I didn't have a very good race there. And, you know, obviously so with dealing with all this. I also remember there was one time in my preparations for this, and at the time, it had been the only time I had ever quit a training session. I remember, I think it was like a week before all this, is right as all this was going on. So just before the trial, I remember the workout. I remember this day so clearly because it, I still remember it to this day because it was the one time, the only time I ever just quit a training ride with no real reason. And I remember my coach had given me, Rick had given me, you know, 5 by 5 minute TT efforts to do out on the classic country roads where I'd always trained. And I remember I got through the first two, and on the third one, I just stopped and just sat in the field on the side of the road and started crying because I didn't know, like, what the hell am I training for? Why am I working so hard? If, you know, they might not even let me go to the race, why am I preparing so hard for this? They may not even let me race the World Championships. And I was just so broken and upset. And I quit the session and I went home. And that's, it stuck with me this whole time. It's like, you just quit there. Because, like, there was no reason for me to quit other than the fact that I gave up on myself there. And that really hurt. And that still sticks with me to this day as that one time. But, you know, obviously there's been training sessions I have not finished before, but there's been reasons for that. You know, like being tired or sick or, you know, whatever. However, I've gotten soft since then. But I was a pretty hard bastard at the time. And, so the race happens, and then as soon as the race ends, I remember, whenever you're with Cycling Canada or any of the nations, as soon as your race is over, what they did is they selected me for the time trial, but they didn't pick me for the road race because they were worried with all this going on. Like, I was for sure, I was the strongest rider in Canada at the time, but they didn't pick me for the road race because if it came out that they were going to, because of all this, they were going to wipe out my results or something like that, they would, they didn't want to wipe out the whole team's results, or they were worried that this could affect all the riders' results because the road race is a team sport versus the time trial is individual. So I didn't get picked for that, and as soon as you're done your race, they basically, like, you can't stay with the national team anymore. So, you know, they don't kick you out, but, you know, like, okay, you can't stay at the team accommodation anymore. And I ended up, my parents had booked the flight ticket for a couple days later for me to leave, so they found a little place, like in a I guess like a hotel room or a hostel or something like that, for me to stay for a couple nights there before I flew home, and then I could at least, you know, see a little bit of Italy. And I guess they were like, oh yeah, you know, try to enjoy Italy a little bit there, but, you know, this is all going on, of course I'm not going to enjoy Italy. Are you kidding me? Like, and, you know, also what kind of 18-year-old kid that is only trying to focus on racing and whatnot is gonna have any appreciation for, you know, the beauty of Italy at that time? But I don't think I'd ever had even like a beer at that point in time. Like, I didn't go to any high school parties. I didn't smoke. I didn't drink. All I did was focus on cycling, and all I had was cycling. And I was so broken at that point. And I remember in Italy, you can buy alcohol at 18 or however young you need to be there. And I remember just buying like a big bottle of Jack Daniels and I'm being like, well, I want to try this. And I just remember I spent that night just drinking Jack Daniels and Coke in my hotel room by myself, just being so depressed and sad as to, you know, what was happening to my life, and my life was being ripped apart, and I'm just alone in this hotel room by myself, and nobody's going to believe me when all this comes out. All this is going to be made public soon, and no one's going to believe me. And I remember just drinking, and, you know, I'd never had any alcohol before in my life, so I didn't know how much I could drink. And I remember just puking all over the place. And, you know, it's truly a miracle that I didn't kill myself that night with alcohol. Like, I got lucky that that wasn't the last night of my life there, because I definitely wasn't responsible enough to deal with that at the time. And anyways, this happens. And I get back on a plane, I fly home, I have like one day, I'm living in Toronto with my family at the time, and I have like one day at home, not even one day, I think it was like 18 hours between that flight and then getting on a flight to go to start university. And there's a whole other story. As far as, you know, I was on my way to university, whereas all my teammates were on their way to a Cycling Canada track camp they were starting up, and I got invited to, but I didn't have the money for that. You know, there was a bill you had to pay, and you had to go train in California, and, you know, my parents basically laughed when they, you know, I asked them, you know, if I could go do this, and there's no freaking way you got the money to do that. So I was off to school, but, you know, that was okay, because I was so excited to go to Squamish, BC. The BC I had dreamed of since I was in the fourth grade. It had been my dream way before road cycling, any of the racing or any of this nonsense. I wanted to go be a mountain biker in the Whistler Bike Park and watching, you know, the coastal crew guys in the North Shore and Squamish and Whistler. So this dream was coming true. Even though all this was happening in my life, I was on my way to Squamish, BC, which was so cool for me, just to go to school there at the time. There was no intention to live there at the time. And so I throw all my stuff in bags and jump on another plane to go. You know, I pack up my life in like whatever it was, 18 hours, 12 hours, something like that, get on another plane and go to university and go start to figure that out for, you know, go be a college kid now for the first time in my life. And I remember on the very last day that the UCI could appeal this whole trial that was going on, they have 30 days. On the 30th day, I was walking through my dorm room on the way to one of my classes, and I was in the hallway, and I got the email saying they're appealing this. And I thought, you know, maybe we're done with this. Maybe, I was counting down the days, you know, maybe they're just going to let it go. Maybe they realized that, you know, I was innocent here, and they were just going to let it go at this point. But no, they appealed the case, and we got to go through everything all over again and get ready for the second trial that's now going to happen in New York. And so the hearing is going to happen in New York City, and everyone's going to have to fly in for that. So the UCI is flying in from Switzerland, and we have to fly in there. And you know, we certainly didn't have the money to do that in a hotel room in New York and a flight there and whatnot. So we're really hoping that we would win this case, because then the UCI would have to pay our expenses. And thank God that did happen. But again, we go to this New York trial, this hearing. I'm sorry. We go to this hearing, and another massive boardroom. All these suits are there, and the lawyer for the UCI, so kind of like the prosecutor in a trial, that's supposed to be pointing the finger at me and saying, you're guilty, blah, 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 whatever they want to throw the book at me for. He opens with this statement saying, we know you did nothing wrong. We want to make sure that's clear to everybody here. No one here thinks you're a cheater. We just need to, we've had to go through this whole process because your case is very precedent setting. And my jaw just hit the floor, and like I said before, I was just angry and mad and confused. It's like, you're just sacrificing my whole life here for this, like, to try to worry about precedent for some future athletes. Like, what about me? Like, what about my career? And, you know, of course, we go through the whole hearing, and then Whereas the first hearing, they didn't have time, or we didn't have time to test supplements and water and get water experts and all this stuff to prove everything. So I was given a first strike, and they took away my results, even though they didn't give me a sanction. It was still counted as a first strike. So what that would mean is if I were to test positive again and be found guilty, instead of getting a 2-year ban, I'd get a lifetime ban. That's all that means. And but now that we were able to prove everything, we were able to get all the supplements tested, we were able to, and for anyone that's curious, the supplements at the time, I believe, were veggie greens. It's just like a daily veggie greens. Like, I think it's exactly what it says. It's just like a something you take every day. It's just to get your vegetables in. The First Endurance EFS drink mix powder. I really like that stuff. And, you know, that's what I was drinking at the time. And then, like, some Louis Garneau gels. That's just what, you know, we got from Cycling Canada. And there was some protein powder. I think it was just, like, yeah, it's just some random protein powder, I think, was also in there. But we got everything tested, and everything came back. There was no, and we spent a lot of money testing all those supplements, but we found, you know, there's nothing there. And then we went through the whole well water procedure, and we were able to prove that, yes, there are extremely high amounts of hydrochlorothiazide in that water that I drank before there. And, like, there's no way, this is, like, that was it. We had proven the case. And, again, the UCI, the most they could throw at me was, we think this could be contaminated supplements. But then, even now going into this case, they kind of realized, oh, wait a minute, no, he's telling the truth here. This is kind of like a screw-up in the system. And the way this works, just if anyone's curious, is hydrochlorothiazide, it's completely safe to consume, obviously. They prescribe it to senior citizens often, and it's a drug that's found really commonly in there. And so your normal drinking water filtration system wouldn't filter it out, because it's okay to drink it. It's not harmful to humans. It's not like lead in your water. Like, it's okay to drink it. And even at the amount they found in me, you can have way more of that. Even if it was lead that they found in my system, you could have way more lead in the drinking water and it would be safe. But the thing is, the filtration system we have for drinking water is at one standard, is set at one standard to make sure it's safe for humans to drink. But then what the UCI and their water labs can test for is way, way more specific. And what's the word I'm looking for? It's way more, it can find much smaller amounts. It's much more refined than what the filtration system can filter out the drinking water. So that's the problem, is, like, you just drink normal drinking water, it's filtered, it's safe, it's normal for any human to drink, but if you're an athlete that's going to be tested by this incredible system to catch doping cheats, it's, you'll test positive because it's so much more refined than the drinking water system is. Even if you're drinking bottled water and everything else, they don't need to filter it as fine as what they're using to catch drug cheats. That's the big difference there. And the other thing is, you know, again, this is a drug that just makes you pee. It's not a performance-enhancing drug. You know, if it was like testosterone or EPO or growth hormone or something like that that you're not going to find in drinking water and it was performance-enhancing, that would be a different story. So that's, you know, why Contador's story didn't really add up with people or sit well with people, because it's like, wait a minute, this is actually a performance-enhancing drug. What they found in me is used to hide, it either dehydrates you or it hides performance enhancing things, and there's not enough to hide anything anyway. So, like, it just, there's nothing that adds up. You could want to make the case against me and label me as a doper and try to come up with a scenario. There's no scenario you can come up with, and with facts, and without just making stuff up, that adds up. That's why the UCI came out and acknowledged that, you know, listen, we know this isn't what it looks like, but there is a lot of precedent to be set here. And just to give you an idea as to, you know, like, what some of the rumors and the backlash was when all this was made public, and because so much of this information wasn't, like, there were ridiculous rumors and hate mail that I got. I heard a rumor one time that, oh, his dad's a pharmacist, and that's where he must have got the drugs from. You know, that's where all this happened, because I'm like an 18-year-old kid, like, how would I know how to do any of this anyways? But someone made up the rumor that my dad's a pharmacist. my dad's a bus driver. Like, my dad knows about as much as pharmaceuticals and drugs and all this stuff as, you know, Tony's auto body and transmission shop. You know, like this, that was completely made up. There was another one I heard, someone made up the story that, oh, I heard you were drinking cough medicine. And, you know, like people just made up these insane stories about me. And the hate mail I got from like master cyclists, like 40 to 50 year old men on the other side of the country that I had never met, never heard of. And then there were even ones that like I had beaten in local provincial races. They're all making up these stories about me, like grown men that are doing this. And I'm, you know, an 18 year old kid at the time. That was crushing to hear that at the time, to hear this stuff from people. And I hated cycling after that. It was like, it was everything I had, and then I completely hated it. And I loved riding my bike, and that's what I want, but I really went away from cycling after all of that happened. There were even, there was a one, I'm not going to name them, it was a Canadian magazine that has since gone under, but they wrote an article about me, a really negative article about my whole case before a lot of the facts were out, and they wrote it based on just the findings from the first trial before we were able to prove everything with testing. They basically made a whole article that they didn't say it, but they made it seem like, oh, they let him off because he was a kid, and or because they didn't do their job properly because this was a rushed process and all this stuff like that. It was a really negative article that was trying to cast some doubt in it. And they specifically put it out right as the 2016 Olympics were coming, like right as everybody was clicking on to, like they did the article just to get clicks, basically. It was really shitty journalism in the sense where like they were using my case to try to stir up stuff and saying things that weren't true, like just insinuating things and casting doubt on the story because they didn't have all the facts. And so they were saying things, they were talking about what they didn't know what they were talking about, just to try to get some clicks and whatnot, right as everybody's clicking on cycling and sport because the Olympics are happening. And the other thing to remember is all this happened in 2013. The whole Lance Armstrong, Oprah interview, the whole sport blowing up happened months before this. That happened in 2012. This happened months later in 2013. There was not one person on the face of this earth that would have believed me if I said, oh, I tested positive, but I didn't do it, because the entire sport had just admitted to doping after saying, I didn't do it for how long. Like, there could not have been a worse time for all this to come out, that, you know, what had happened there. And so anyways, I'm now at university. We've gone through the second trial. I got my results back. I feel like, well, okay, that's great. You know, no other athlete has ever been found completely not guilty. And of course, there's still going to be all the backlash and whatnot when this all goes public and the Toronto Star article is now coming out. And that's when I got this email or this letter from Pat McQuaid at the UCI saying, sign this NDA or we're going to take away your Abitibi result, which I already explained, I said, okay, well, you can have the Abitibi result because there's no way I'm signing an NDA about this. So that really sucks, and I hope they give me that result back. At some point, like I always said, at some point I want them to reverse that and give me that result back, because I don't think they're allowed to do that. And that's, you know, that's just bullying and blackmail to try to basically shut me up, or we're going to take your result away. I mean, Abitibi's not a big result, but it's just kind of, it's annoying at this point. Like, you know, I earned that result. We proved that in this, and now you're just bending the rules in order to cover it up because you look like a bunch of bullies, you know, ruining my life to, you know, make sure there's no precedent for future cases. So that really hurt. So the next stage was basically, you know, I didn't end up getting any sanction or 2-year ban out of this. This happened in 2013, but as the whole cycling world is falling apart with all these doping scandals now coming to light, of course, nobody is going to believe my case. And with so much of the information not out there, and it's slowly coming out, and, you know, cycling journalists reporting on some of it, but not getting all the facts right, you know, I had no hope in hell at this, really. Like, teams wouldn't look at me. You know, I don't like to think of how many teams, like I was the best junior coming out of Canada at the time, and I couldn't get on any of these teams for the under 23 years. And these are your key years where you're supposed to be, you know, making the jump up to the pros. And a lot of these teams would ignore me. They wouldn't answer emails, or they would flat out tell me, you know, we don't believe you. And, you know, they would be some of the ones sending hate mail and saying things about, like, just making up complete rumors. And there's ones that, and, you know, when I was talking to Mike Creed about this, he asked me if, you know, I'm angry about that. And I'm not. I'm really not. Because I don't blame a lot of those directors and what happened. Because the first thing is, it's not fair to them that a lot of this information was never made public, quite strategically, is the first thing. The second point is, it is a really crazy story. And unless you get all the facts, I wouldn't believe it either. Like, if, you know, if all I heard was there's this junior cyclist that was beating everybody and doing really well, and he tested positive and he blamed it on contaminated well water, if I didn't hear the whole story, I wouldn't believe it either. So that, like, I don't blame them for that and not getting all the information. But then, as, you know, more of the information was made public and you could read into all of it, a lot of them still, a lot of directors and teams and sponsors wouldn't read all those articles. They would just hear a rumor, or they'd read a headline and they would make their decision based on that. And you could argue it's like, hey, you know what, why don't you guys just give them a chance and read the whole thing? But, you know, I still put a lot of that on myself, as far as, well, you know, if I was on the edge, if it was like me and another rider on the edge of, on the verge, they had to decide between one or two of us to get on the team, of course they're going to pick the other rider, because they only need to read a headline about me. That, you know, why, if I wanted to get on those teams, I could have been even better. You know, if I should have been a better cyclist and made myself more desirable to those teams and made it so I was so desirable that they would spend that extra time to look into it. But if I'm only good enough to kind of be on the edge of almost getting onto this team, then yeah, of course they're not going to go reading in all the articles and educate themselves that much on it. And that, you know, that sucks. But I got really lucky with some guys, you know. Eventually, after, so the other, so there was a lot of dealing with the hate mail and, you know, being like ousted in the sport, basically, and treated like a dope. I was completely 100% treated like a doper in the sport, and I got hate mail. I'd have people, you know, looking at me the wrong way when I'd show up at races, and I'm looking at them like, guys, like, I didn't do it. Like, just read the whole case. I'm begging with these guys to read into my case and look at it and just listen to me. Like, you don't need to listen to my opinion. I'll just give you the facts and you make your own decision. And people wouldn't have time for that. And that's, you know, it's a really complicated story, and I understand that. But the first pro team I ended up getting onto, like Continental Pro Team, was H&R Block. And I credit Mark Ernstein, the one who ran that team out of Vancouver, so much for that, because he did look into my case and he did read everything that was there, and he gave me that chance. And that, like, I'm so thankful for him for doing that at the time. But even after he gave me that chance, when even club teams on, like, there was the big club team in Vancouver at the time, they were thinking that I was a doper and saying mean things about me at the time. And now, funny enough, like a year ago, last year, they were asking me to come ride some Grand Fondo for them because they realized they were wrong. You know, it's funny how karma comes around that time. Of course, I didn't end up doing it, but at the time, Mark gave me that chance to ride on H&R Block, and that was my first pro team. That was now years later. This wasn't the next year. It took years for me, so I probably wasted this happened in 2013, and I believe I rode with H&R Block in 2016. So there were several years there where I couldn't get any teams to look at me there. And at the same time, I hated cycling at the time. I decided, like, road cycling, this sucks. These people suck. I hate this. And I just went on just riding my bike, just enjoying riding my bike. And just, I liked training and I liked working hard, but I wanted nothing to do with road cycling anymore. And so it's almost like I kind of gave myself my own ban from the sport at that time, because I felt unwelcomed in the sport and I had so much resentment for it at the time. And so Mark gave me that chance. I signed the contract. I was so excited to sign a pro contract there. And then Mark gets an email from one of the major sponsors of the team saying to fire me because they put my name into Google and the first thing that comes up is rider test positive for this. And they're seeing these articles and all they saw was the headline, and they called Mark and said, fire him. We don't want our name associated with him. And Mark looks at them and is like, well, did you read the article? Did you read what actually happened in his case? Like, they found him not guilty. He's the only athlete that's, you know, this unique case. And the sponsor literally said, we don't care. We don't want our name associated with him. We don't care if he's innocent or he claims to be innocent or whatever. We don't care how favorable it looks. We don't want our name next to him. And like, that hurt at the time. And I mean, I don't even know what to feel right now. I think pity is almost what I feel now at this level. But like, that gives just, and I was really naive to this. I didn't want to believe that that was what was happening behind the scenes at the time. And I still don't like to believe that. But, you know, that's the reality. Like, Mark explained that to me. And what Mark had to really go to bat for me there in order to let them, like, just let me stay on the team is, you know, what Mark finally said to them is like, what if this was your kid? What if this was your kid that this happened to? What would you do? Like, don't you want him to get a chance? He deserves this. He didn't do anything wrong. And, you know, I credit Mark for giving me that chance. And then, you know, Mike Creed had to give me that same chance the next year later. And I really credit those guys for taking the time to look into my case, because they easily could have just picked another rider. I wasn't, you know, so good that they had to, you know, go that it was a, you know, they easily could have picked another rider on the team, but they chose me and they took the time to read into my case. And I'm forever grateful for that, that they chose to do that. And, but yeah, for a long time, for several years, I hated cycling. I wanted nothing to do with it. I just wanted to ride my bike. And I was so determined at the time to outwork everybody that was at those training camps down in California while I was going to school. I was convinced that I'm going to ride in my head, they were training 35 hours a week. That's just, you know, I just imagined that. I made that up in my head. And so I said, I'm going to train the 35 hours a week and be going to school at the same time. And so I'd be training through the middle of the night and, you know, finishing training rides at 2 or 3 in the morning and starting other ones at 4 in the morning, like just depending on what my school schedule was. And I had one of those 1 liter Stanley thermoses, the classic gray ones that I was filling up with French press coffee every morning. And I was down in that just to stay awake. And I was watching videos about the Navy SEALs in Hell Week and how they don't sleep for a week and justifying that, oh, well, they don't sleep at all. Like, I can definitely just do this and tough it out and get through it. And the thing was, there had been articles written about me now in this whole case in the cycling world, and everyone in the cycling world knew it, but I kind of felt like I was getting a fresh start at university because there was no cyclists there. And so no one had ever brought it up, and I was on the other side of the country. I was 5,000 kilometers away from where I grew up, and I felt like I was getting a fresh start almost. And then one of my friends there just casually brought it up one time, my whole case, and my heart basically just fell on the floor like, oh, what the hell? Like, you know about this? And he's like, yeah, of course, everybody knows. Like, we Googled your name. We were just excited about it. We Googled your name because they're thinking, you know, here's this awesome guy that went to the World Championships and Team Canada for cycling and all this stuff, and they Google my name, and that's the first thing that comes up. And, you know, that just, you know, broke my heart, really, that all these guys, everybody at school knows about this, but nobody's asked me about it, so no one knows all the facts about this. So I'm wondering, do they think I'm a doper? And then you feel all the shame of actually being someone who's guilty. You feel just as much shame because you know that everybody here must be questioning you. They must, you know, have some questions because they don't know all the facts. And that's not their fault. And so you feel all the shame of that. And to me, it really felt like I was being accused of murder. And I know that sounds insane, but cycling was my whole world at the time. And it all just came apart and it all came crumbling down on me. And I was so angry at the time at guys like Lance Armstrong and them. I wanted someone to blame. I'm not angry with those guys now. I'm not at all, because, you know, I don't want to get into that, but I'm not angry with them. But at the time I was so angry at the situation that I wanted someone to blame. And the same thing happened when I went to the local bike shop, and the exact same conversation happened. They just happened to drop my case in a conversation at one point, and again you're thinking, damn it, they know too, and they say, oh yeah, everybody on the ride, the group ride that they go on, they were all talking about it, all talking about your case, and so everybody's talking about your case, but no one's talking about it to you because they don't want to bring it up around you, so you don't know that they know, and they only know some of the facts, and they don't want to ask you about it, and you know, it was hard for me to talk about, and so I was kind of grateful they weren't asking me about it. But then at the same time, you want people to ask you about it so you can make sure they understand the whole case. So I feel like I'm rambling a little bit now, so I'm going to try to wrap this up with a couple last points here. And then we'll do this as like a two-part thing where I'll do another podcast with Mike Creed and then maybe some other people. And if you have any questions about this, please, things that I didn't make clear, questions you might still have, or even try, like, you could make this anonymous and say, like, I don't believe you, and, you know, here's why I don't believe you. Like, try to poke holes in it. Like, anything I haven't answered, please just send them to me, and I would love the opportunity to try to answer questions, because that's the thing, is I haven't really had the opportunity to do that, because I don't know, who knows, and, you know, this was just hard for me to talk about, and I haven't talked, this happened 7 years ago, and this is the first time I'm talking about this. So, but again, I don't expect you to just listen to me for all this. I tried to just lay out the facts as best I can. If you want some other resources to read into this, there's a couple articles out there, but probably the best ones that give like the most full picture of everything that happened was the Toronto Star article that came out closer to all this happening, more back in 2013. So if you just Google Jack Burke, Toronto Star, I'm sure it comes up right there. Another one was Cycling Canada. Canadian Cycling Magazine. Canadian Cycling Magazine, they did almost like a follow-up of this, maybe like a year, 2 years ago, something like that. I think it was in 2018 they did it. There's a podcast that you can listen to. So if you go in Apple Podcasts and you search for Canadian Cycling Magazine, there, I think this was like their fifth episode, and I think the title is A Chainsaw, an Olympic Track Rider, Plus a Failed Drug Test That Won't Go Away. And they talk about my case in that. And then they also wrote a full article that is basically telling the same story as the podcast that you can read online as well. And that gives, those stories give a pretty, they don't tell all the facts, but they go into a lot of it. One thing I will say about that Canadian Cycling, one thing I don't like that they said about that is when they're telling the story about me, they say, oh, he had these mediocre results. And this is like me nitpicking here, but they say, oh, he had these mediocre results in the first two stages of Abitibi, and then he wins the time trial. And when you listen to that, it comes across like, oh, he's like not doing so well, and then, oh, clearly he must have taken some drugs and then he wins the time trial. That's not the case at all. The first, every other stage in Abitibi, for anyone who's ever done it, or you just look at the results, they're all just sprint finishes except the time trial. Like, the time trial is basically what decides the GC for the race. Anyone who's ever done Abitibi, it's, you know, 180 riders, and I'm not a sprinter, so I would just roll in. So I'm sure I probably came like 50th or 70th or something like that in those first stages, but was on the same time as everybody else. I was going for the GC, and I wasn't trying to sprint to win the stage, and I'm pretty sure we ended up winning those state. Here's another thing they don't get. I'm pretty sure we won those first two stages with our sprinter on the team. So, you know, Canadian Cycling, get your shit together and, you know, do some better reporting here. I know it's only junior cycling, but hey, get it together. Sorry, I'm really nitpicking here, but that's they go into the story there. And then another thing to bring up is when I was staying at that hotel, just to give, I just think this is funny because I was so naive to cycling at the time. Cycling wasn't a part of my life at all. I just liked riding my bike when all this was happening. I didn't know anything about pro road racing. You know, I probably only learned what UCI stood for maybe like 8 or 9 months before any of this even happened. Like, I was very green to all the bike racing that was going on. And so I didn't know who Marianne Vos was or Pauline Ferrand-Prévot. And this was the year where she was the world champion in cross-country cyclocross and mountain biking. And of course, all these junior men are all looking at her and just were staying at the same place. And they're like, hi, Pauline, like just total dorks. But I remember what stood out to me was seeing that they had their team Rabobank suitcases. They had these bright orange suitcases from the team, and I thought those were so cool. Like, I want one of those. Like, that's what I was actually excited about at the time, because I didn't know who they were and their results on the race. I just thought, wow, those are cool team suitcases. I wonder if I could get that one day. And then when they're leaving after they won the team time trial, I just remember seeing Pauline just dragging it through the gravel, just scraping the crap out of it and just laughing like, well, she's world champion in three disciplines. She clearly does not care very much about this suitcase, even though I think that's pretty cool. Like looking up, like they're in the big leagues to me at the time. But I don't know. I thought that was just a funny story to wrap this up with. And I guess, okay, one last thing where I'll leave it at is the quote that got me through all those years. And like I said, I was watching the Rocky movies like crazy at the time. And I just, the quote that stuck with me was, it ain't about how hard you hit, it's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning's done. It's the classic Rocky quote. And that's what got me through that long period of time. And last fall, I ended up getting that tattooed on my left forearm. And I never thought I'd get a tattoo. When I was growing up, I'd make fun of my friends that had tattoos, and I'd make fun of anyone I knew that had tattoos and say, like, hey, you don't put a bumper sticker on a Ferrari. That's why I'll never get a tattoo. Like, you know, very arrogant kid. But, you know, I ended up getting that tattoo. And then several of the letters are underlined if you look closely at it. And the underlined letters are an acronym for always be the hardest worker in the room. And I got that as those are the two quotes that kind of govern my life. Is I call it my hammer in the nail tattoo. Is you have to always try to, you know, again, this is very much so just going into my personality now, but you always have to try to be the hardest worker in the room and prepare to be that hammer. You want to show up at the races and just be that sledgehammer that's just, you've trained so hard and prepared so well, you're just going to show up and smash the shit out of everybody when you get there. You know, you're going to be the hammer, not the nail. And, you know, that's how you're preparing. And it actually goes back to an analogy Mike Creed gave me as far as, you know, showing up to a race and being a huge hammer instead of worrying about marginal gains and stuff like that. But in the other quote, it ain't about how hard you hit, it's about how hard you can get hit, is more referring to the nail that's just been bent and hit and battered around so much, but never, you know, just always resisting. And you've been hit and you've been the nail so many times, but never finished off into the board. And just that one resilient nail. So that's, I just thought that was kind of cool that, you know, that quote first kind of really became really powerful to me 7 years ago when I went through all of this and was watching the Rocky movies to hype myself up to get through training and to get through this and not quit on cycling. Because at the time I was thinking, well, if I quit, everybody's going to think I was a doper and I have to keep working even harder now to show them that no, I wasn't doing this. And, you know, last year I ended up actually getting that as a tattoo on my arm. So, yeah, I just figured I'd end with those stories. And again, if anyone has any questions about this, please, please, please reach out to me. I'm amazed I kept it together talking about this whole story. This is dredging up a lot from the past for me. But if you have any questions, let me know. And Mike and I are going to do another podcast. And we'll just talk about this. And I guess he'll probably ask me questions, things I didn't make clear. I know I rambled a lot here. I was just trying to go through the facts as I remembered. But okay. I hope you enjoyed this ridiculous story. I hope it wasn't too negative for you. Yeah, all right, I'll leave it there. I hope you're having a sweet day, everyone. Get outside, and hopefully there's nice weather to enjoy.